Support for The Full Story comes from Long Wharf Theater, creating theater of, for, and by the people of Greater New Haven. Everyone's story has a place at Long Wharf. You belong.
Let's say marijuana is legalized in New York and Connecticut. And let's say you own a business. How would legalization impact your company, especially when it comes to drug testing? Welcome to The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. Today we have the second part of our look at some of the issues regarding the potential legalization of marijuana in New York and Connecticut. Now, is that going to happen? Look, frankly, who knows? I mean, last year some proponents said it was a slam dunk, but that dunk bounced off the back of the rim. So let's see what happens over the next few weeks. But there are plenty of issues to talk about because many contend that if it doesn't happen this year, eventually it's going to happen. Now, one of the big issues that we'll talk about today, and we're going to do it in the first segment here. Later on, we'll be talking about other issues. One of the big issues is how this will impact business. What if you own a business and you currently do random drug tests? What's going to happen in the future? Rue Dooley is with us. Rue is a knowledge advisor at the Society for Human Resource Management. Hi, Rue. Thanks for coming on today.
Hey, Ron. How you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you. Thanks for your time.
Sure.
Rue, I got to start it with this question because there are so many defense contractors in this region. Some of them even work on nuclear subs. So if marijuana does go legal, what are they supposed to do if an employee indulges on a weekend?
Well, safety is number one. And so far, we have some examples around the country where marijuana is legal, both medical use of marijuana and the recreational use of marijuana. And so we already have some examples. Most of that legislation is written in a way where there's an out, if you will, for employers. When it comes to safety, employers have some room, some flexibility to make sure that they screen out employees who aren't ready, prepared, equipped fully to do the job, just like with alcohol.
Hmm. But in terms of safety, so I was at an auto store the other week, and I'm looking around and I'm looking at all the heavy equipment in there. I mean, look, it's you're not building nuclear subs, but there are a lot of things there that if they fall over, if they get mishandled, it could be unsafe. So even a business like that, would that qualify?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of forklift operators are in safety-sensitive positions. And so even the guys that are working in the warehouse of the electric supply company down the street or around the corner, they're in safety-sensitive positions. And so even though their state may say, so if Connecticut decides to pass this, and eventually they probably will, that's the trend, the employer gets to say, yeah, but you, given the position that you're in, you have to be ready, up to the job, equipped. And just because if the legislation changes and they're not able to do pre-employment drug testing,
mm-hmm.
they're more than likely still going to be able to do post-accident testing. It's a shame. We want to avoid accidents in the first place, but reasonable suspicion testing is usually not done away with either. So post-accident testing will still likely remain. Reasonable suspicion testing will also still likely remain, even though folks are free to do whatever they want over the weekend.
What about random drug testing?
Well, that's a little bit different. It depends on how the legislation is written. There are some states that have, because of the way their new laws are written, it sort of takes away that privilege from employers. Because the employer cannot discriminate based on the use of marijuana. So if you randomly test for marijuana, what are you testing for? So unless it's, if you have an accountant or an actuary, somebody, or an HR knowledge advisor who just sits behind a desk and, is not operating any safety-sensitive equipment or in that sort of an environment, then it doesn't really matter. So randomly testing me or an actuary is probably not defensible.
But I guess I was confused about this because from what I've read, let's say Friday work finishes. It's 5 o'clock. It's the weekend is here. You go out that night and instead of having a few beers, maybe you go home. Maybe you smoke a joint or you chew a gummy or something like that. So you're not high and you just stop Friday night. So you're not high when you go back to work on Monday. But from what I've been told, the THC is still in your system. So even though you're not impaired, you will still test positive. Is that accurate?
Probably. The science of it, I'm no expert at. But it probably would, but it wouldn't really matter, right? Because...
Well, I'm just saying, what if there was an accident on Monday and you were one of those called in to do that testing because you were around that accident scene or maybe you had something to do with it? That's where it's I'm struggling to understand this. How would it work?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. You know, it would sort of, and ideally, it's a unique situation, one that we haven't had before, but we do have some precedents where if you think about alcohol, once upon a time, it was prohibited, and we had to go in and change fundamental legislation in our country, if you recall. So if I go out and have some drinks Sunday evening or even Saturday and come in and there's an accident on Monday, and let's say I don't test positive for alcohol. Let's look at it both ways. I don't test positive for alcohol. My employer still gets to test me. And if I do test, and I get to suffer consequences, whether it's in my system or not, if I'm in a safety-sensitive position, for most positions, it's not going to matter because there isn't going to be an accident, right? So if I don't test positive, I still suffer consequences for the accident. If I do test positive, I'm not being punished if the law says I can't be punished for using it, right? But the law is usually written so that I can be punished for using anything that impairs my ability to do the job. So the timing doesn't really matter. What matters is, can I do my job? Can I do it well without jeopardizing the safety or the health of my coworkers or myself?
It almost sounds like you're saying, look, if you care about your job, be careful. Even though it's your own time and it's legal, be careful.
That is precisely what I'm saying. Because the same thing is true with legal. Because today, as you and I have this conversation, marijuana is still an illicit substance. The federal government sees it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so... Yeah, you know, and that's the most confusing part me, anyway.
Oh, definitely. Not only that, in terms of the banking system, also. If you're selling, if it becomes legal, where do the sellers actually end up putting their money? That's for another program. What else are you hearing from the owners and the managers? What are they concerned about with this?
You know, interestingly, we get lot of calls from a lot of different organizations, large, small, public sector, private sector, and even around the world. So we're in a good place to hear from a little bit of everybody. And I've been doing this for about 19 years. So one of the interesting things, Ron, that I've heard recently was that the workplace smells like weed. It smells like marijuana because they legalized, and this is up in Colorado, the use of marijuana, both medicinally, recreationally, various amounts. So people are just free to do whatever they want. And so in a particular call center, it just smells more and more like weed. And coworkers in my generation are having a problem with the employees who are not having a problem participating in the free use of marijuana and marijuana products up there. So the smell of it, and that's a strange one because you wouldn't think that would be the one, but the smell of the workplace, that's one of the things I'm hearing. The other is, you and I discussed it already, which is safety concerns. That's a major concern. I think that's probably the number one concern. Even drug testing is not as big a concern as how do we make sure that our workplace is safe, the environment is safe, even when it comes to how marijuana is secured? Are people buying them from, quote unquote, legitimate sources, and, you know, instead of a dealer who may be associated with criminal activity and so on? How do we keep our workplace safe and our employees safe? So safety, not just the warehouse. The warehouse, yes. The construction site, yes. But not just those things. Also, the things on the periphery, right? How do we keep employees safe if they're free to indulge in this, federally anyway, illicit substance? So those are some of the main things that I'm hearing. One of the things that comes out of all of those, workers' comp claims, especially for smaller employers, you know, if there are injuries sustained and sometimes illnesses sustained, and sometimes the use of marijuana is because somebody already has an injury or an illness or a disability even that the employer didn't know of. So when the employer becomes aware of an employee's use of marijuana, now they are almost, it's a window sometimes to the health condition or even the disability that they didn't know of before of an employee. And now that they know, they have a responsibility to be reasonable about accommodating that disability.
Incredible. The amount of issues. Rue Dooley, Knowledge Advisor at the Society for Human Resource Management. Rue, it was a pleasure. Thank you. Please come back with us.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Anytime. Give us a call.
Take care. It's The Full Story on WSHU. We'll take that first break. We'll be right back. It's The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. Remember, you can join us on Facebook at Full Story WSHU, and all our shows are available as podcasts. You can download The Full Story on Google Play or an Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or Spotify. And if you go to our website, WSHU.org, you can stream our program. We are talking about the potential legalization of marijuana in New York and Connecticut. Now, there's some question as to whether Connecticut and New York are going to pass it this year or sometime in the future. We just don't know, but more and more we're hearing, look, it's probably likely. We're going to get some additional perspectives now. Dr. David Nathan is joining us. Dr. Nathan is the president and the founder of Doctors for Cannabis Regulation. Dr. Nathan, welcome. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yesterday, we also heard about how Colorado was doing since marijuana was legalized there. Dr. Libby Stout is joining us from Colorado. Dr. Stout is an addiction psychiatrist in Colorado who runs a 90-day inpatient treatment program. Dr. Stout, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Dr. Nathan, I'm going to start with you, if that's okay, because we need some background. Tell us about Doctors for Cannabis Regulation. When did you form your group? How many doctors belong to it? And what are your goals?
Doctors for Cannabis Regulation was created in 2015 by a number of prominent physicians, including former Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders, integrative medicine pioneer Andrew Weil, and many other doctors that are highly respected around academic centers around the country. And the purpose of this group was to show that there are very sound doctors who understand the science of cannabis and understand that the drug, while it can certainly do harm, for example, to the developing brain, it is certainly not of the magnitude that makes sense to have it against the law. You know, I've seen many lives ruined by cannabis arrests, not so many lives by cannabis itself. And so we feel really strongly that a better solution to the prohibition of cannabis is its effective and science-based regulation.
So basically it sounds like you're saying, look, legalization is going to continue to happen across the country. And from a medical perspective, you're advocating more informed and thoughtful legislation?
That's right. And we do wholeheartedly support legalization, make no mistake. It's not as though this is somehow, you know, a consolation for the legalization that's happening anyway. Of course, it is happening, but it needs to happen because prohibition itself is a failure. And there are many ways in which prohibition has failed in its most basic intent to keep cannabis away from kids. Most adults aren't harmed by it, and it's certainly not as bad as alcohol for adults. And because of that, we think that the cost of prohibition, which is in terms of human lives incarcerated, families ruined, and billions of dollars wasted on enforcement of a drug that is here to stay, it's not going away.
Dr. Stout, thank you for your patience. How are you doing?
I'm good.
How long have you been running your inpatient treatment program in Colorado?
For the past 20 years.
All right, so it's fair to say that you are experienced?
Yes, I would say I have a great deal of experience with addiction and with cannabis.
So you?
I would say that I am not a prohibitionist at all. I am very much against the commercialization of this product. And I really have problems with the lack of regulation. In Colorado, we don't have regulation on many things we need regulation on. And I strongly encourage states that are considering this to first look at your medical and make sure your medical is regulated. Because the problem is this high-potency THC. With the high-potency plants and the concentrates, where we have gotten THC way out of control. You know, in the 1960s, 70s, it was less than 2%. And when we first voted for it, they voted for it in the state for medical in Colorado, I wasn't that worried about it. I thought it was just going to be what I've always been treating, because I've always been treating cannabis use disorder. But it's never been that severe and never a problem. But with this high-potency stuff, I'm seeing significant problems with increased addiction rates, increased use in children, adolescents, increased risk of psychosis, increased risk of violence and suicide and depression and anxiety. And it's all related to this high potency stuff. And so I looked at websites at some of your dispensaries in Connecticut and New York, and you have stuff in your medical stores that there's no support for in the literature. Yes, there is some support for marijuana being helpful for some medical conditions. But in the research, the maximum amount of THC in the well-designed, rigorous studies was never more than 10%. And so we have all this stuff out there, like I see you've got products that are up to 94% THC. In extracted cannabis oil, in your medical. And the problem is, yes, you can get a medical card from a physician. The medical doctor can say, yes, I recommend that you get a card. But they don't make the diagnosis. They don't say, okay, you need to go get this brand, this amount, use it this often, this route. The person takes the card and goes to the dispensary and can get anything they want. And so in Connecticut, I see you have DAB. I mean, so they may have been told by the physician, yes, it might be helpful for you to use a one-to-one ratio of THC to CBD, and this is what I recommend. And they go there, and the bud tender says, oh, no, you should get some DAB or something.
Hmm.
That's my concern.
Okay, hold on one second. And just to clarify for those who are just joining us and maybe don't know too much about marijuana, whatever, THC is the stuff. I mean, there's no other way to say it. THC is the stuff in there that gets you high. So the more there is of THC, the higher that you're going to get. Dr. Nathan, I want to bring you back in because I'm a boomer. I'm on the tail end of the boomers. And when boomers were smoking probably a lot more in the 60s and 70s, maybe the 80s, as Dr. Stout was saying, marijuana probably wasn't as strong as it is today. Do you two have an issue with the increased potency of the products that are available today?
So the simple answer to that is yes. I think that, you know, with all drugs, the higher the potency, the greater the potential for misuse. So we can agree on that, actually. And I do encourage people, when they're using cannabis, to consider using lower potency preparations. The problem is, when you ban particular products, when you go back to this model of prohibition, when you think that it's a good idea to use the criminal justice system to prevent people from doing something that they're going to do anyway, then you're creating a bigger problem. And I think what's important is to understand that regulation helps people to know what they're getting. So as the system currently is, if you get some strong cannabis product on the illegal market, you have no idea what you're getting. You don't know its strength, and you are pretty much, you know, at the mercy of the person who prepared it. And I'm glad that Dr. Stout agrees about being against prohibition. I think that's great. But I have to correct a couple of things. One thing is that the government's own statistics show that underage use is not increased in the legalized states. And among 12 to 17-year-olds, the incidence seems to actually be trending downward. And, you know, when we talk about the mistakes in regulation, and there certainly have been those, especially in the state of Colorado, where I think they started with too high a tax rate and that preserved the illegal market, the opposite of poor regulation is not no regulation. And when you keep products against the law, you're essentially saying we are not going to regulate it. And Doctors for Cannabis regulation feels like that's a big mistake.
Dr. Stout, this goes back to what you were saying before. You were saying that, and just to clarify, are you for legalization?
Well, it's already here, so I'm not fighting it. I'm just saying, yes, we need to regulate it, and we need to regulate it much better than it's being regulated. And I disagree totally with the lack of increased use in youth, because those studies have been flawed, especially in Colorado. You just have to look at where the studies need to be done is looking at where is the availability of the dispensaries, and that's exactly what is happening now. So there's a study out of Oregon showing that there's increased youth because of where it's available. In Colorado, we have the highest number of dispensaries per 100,000 population. We have 17 dispensaries per 100,000. But Pueblo, Colorado, where I live, which is the epicenter of the cannabis problem, we have 21 dispensaries per 100,000. We have 30% of the youth admitting past 30-day use of marijuana. The other thing is we have 70% of the communities in Colorado have opted out. And so there is less use in communities where they don't have dispensaries. There's more use where the dispensaries are available. And this whole idea of thinking this is going to solve social justice problems, it is not, because where we're putting these dispensaries are in the lower income communities. And because the upper class people, quote, are opting out of having dispensaries in their area.
Dr. Stout, let me hold you right there, yeah. because I'm just tight on time. Dr. Nathan, I need to ask you, because we wanted to get to this. We have heard about an increase in visits to the emergency rooms from all age groups, but really for the younger ones. When I say younger ones, for teens, maybe those in their early 20s. Have you been hearing that, and is that of great concern to you?
That's right. Yeah. Yes, actually, the numbers are up. The numbers are, and that's to the magnitude of maybe 2 to 3 times what it was, which sounds like a major problem. Putting it in context, the numbers are still low, and they're much lower for that of other household chemicals and medications that are lethal in overdose. And of course, we know that cannabis is not lethal in overdose. The other thing is that legally purchased cannabis has childproof packaging, and it's clearly labeled, whereas what comes off the street is not. And finally, I think people feel more comfortable bringing themselves or their loved ones to an ER in legalized states. They bring their children without fear of being referred to the Division of Youth Services. And to me, that's a win for legalization and regulation. And I have to dispute what Dr. Stout is saying about underage use. This is the government's government statistics from Monitoring the Future. It's the largest study done, and we can cherry-pick data that says that the youth use has gone up or down, but the fact is the government statistics show that it is level and in the younger groups going down. And already we have 80 to 90% of our nation's youth saying that they have easy access to cannabis even where it's illegal. So clearly the prohibition doesn't prevent young people from doing it. I think what will prevent it is realistic education and not basically using exaggeration of cannabis's harms to try to scare kids. If we want to educate the public and the children about the harms of underage cannabis use, then we need to stick to the real harms and stop spouting propaganda that makes our kids ignore our admonitions.
Dr. Stott, I'm going to give you a chance just one moment. I am going to just ask Dr. Nathan one more quick question, and then I'll finish up with you, Dr. Stott. Dr. Nathan, do you anticipate sometime in the future that this will become legal nationwide?
Yes, I think so. I actually testified in Congress for their first ever hearing in the House Judiciary about this issue. And there are several bills pending that will decriminalize at the federal level, which then permits legalization at the state level. And one of the most important things that has to happen is that cannabis has to be removed from the Controlled Substances Act, where it currently resides with drugs like PCP and heroin. That have the highest level of restriction, and that's indefensible, and that needs to change at the federal level, and I do believe it will happen in the coming years.
Dr. David Nathan is the president and the founder of Doctors for Cannabis Regulation. Dr. Nathan, thank you, sir. I appreciate your time.
And thank you. Thank you both.
We are still talking with Dr. Libby Stout, who is an addiction psychiatrist in Colorado who runs a 90-day inpatient treatment program there. Dr. Stout, advice for those who are listening. We have many politicians, legislators who enjoy listening to this program, and they're looking at the legislation both for New York State and Connecticut. What advice would you have for them as they go forward?
Well, I have several things that I think absolutely need to happen. And this is applying to their medical first, because I think they have to address their medical first. I do think they should get rid of the high-potency products, because there is nothing medical related to that. If you want that to be in recreational, that's fine. But there is nothing that supports the use of those high-potency products in medical things. I think that it should be on the prescription drug monitoring program. If you're going to make it a medical drug that is helpful for people, it should be on – it's a scheduled drug. Even if it's, you know, not a Schedule I anymore, it's still going to be scheduled. It's addicting. And so it should be on the prescription drug monitoring program. And the bud tenders who actually sell these products to people and make recommendations should be required to have a training where they go through a course where they learn all the downsides of marijuana, all the consequences, because there is a lot of literature supporting the consequences. And yes, it may be only for 20% of the population who are using 80% of the product who become addicted to these things, but there's increased risk of depression, anxiety, psychosis, suicide, violence. These are all things that people need to pay attention to and be recognizing and ready for. And the other big thing we're seeing flooding emergency rooms in Colorado is cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, which has always been around, but it's never been as heavily happening as now. And I think it's because of the high potency products creating addiction where people have to use it all day long every day. And so they start developing this horrible abdominal pain, vomiting, nausea, and they're in the emergency rooms, in and out of the emergency rooms with full workups trying to figure out what's wrong with them. And they can't believe it's their marijuana causing it. And so we're seeing this a lot. It's causing increased healthcare costs. And it actually, you can't say people don't die of cannabis anymore, because there have been several people now dying from cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, because if you vomit enough to decrease all your electrolytes, you can die from that. And so these are things related to the high potency that I think people have to pay attention to. And yes, I think you can regulate that in medical. And if you want to allow it to be there in recreational, that's totally up to you. But the medical should be regulated.
Sounds like you're saying to New York and Connecticut, look before you leap, huh?
Exactly.
Dr. Libby Stout is an addiction psychiatrist in Colorado, and she runs a 90-day inpatient treatment program there. Dr. Stout, thank you. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Be well.
Appreciate it.
We are going to bring in our final two guests now as we wrap up our discussion about the potential legalization of marijuana. Professor Fred McKinney is coming back on the air with us. He is the Carlton Highsmith Chair for Innovation and Entrepreneurship and the director of the People's United Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at the Quinnipiac University School of Business. He recently wrote an opinion piece which was entitled On Marijuana, Race, and Connecticut. Welcome back, Professor. How are you?
I'm good. Glad to be back. And how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. And, Professor, we have a guest joining us for the final segment, the Reverend Abraham Hernandez, who is the executive director of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference of Connecticut. Hi, Reverend.
Well, hi, Ron. Good to be with you this afternoon.
It's our pleasure to have you, sir. Professor, I'm going to start with you. Great piece that you wrote. And I'm going to read some of what you wrote. It says, for decades now, the government has not engaged in a war on drugs, but in a war on black and brown people. Can you expand on that, please?
Oh, certainly. In the article, I also give some data, and it says that basically since the war on drugs was proclaimed by President Reagan in 1980, we've had at least 400,000 Americans arrested every year for over 40 years, and that totals over 20 million people. Most of those people were black people and Hispanics, and there's no evidence that blacks and Hispanics consume marijuana or any other drug for that matter at higher rates than whites. If you look at combine that with incarceration rates, where whites are incarcerated at about 240 per 100,000 in the population, Hispanics are five times that, and African Americans are 10 times that. It tells you that the laws are not equally enforced on issues of drugs and marijuana. And so my gripe with the laws is that they are destroying communities. And it's not the drugs that's the problem. It's the law that is the problem.
Reverend Hernandez, here's what you have written. You wrote the other day, clergy have united to assure our existing communities remain healthy and build a firewall of protection and righteousness against policies that promote the legalization of marijuana. Reverend, why are you against the legalization?
Well, as Professor McKinney stated, yes, the war on drugs the last decades did affect our black and brown communities adversely. But our concern at this time, when we talk about building this firewall, is that in the states which have legalized recreational marijuana, we have seen the opposite of what they stated it intended to do. Example, in Colorado, since they legalized marijuana, blacks are arrested twice as much as the whites due to marijuana-related incidents. And the incarceration of Latinos in Colorado has increased 48%. So when we talk about a social justice issue, that is what raises our eyebrows and brings concerns to us. In Connecticut, if I may add, since they decriminalized it, the trend has gone the opposite direction. In 2017, the OPM, which is Office of Policy and Management in Hartford, stated that 27 people were arrested that year because of marijuana-related incidents. And you don't want to minimize the impact of an arrest that it has on a family, but I live in New Haven. I think that on any given weekend, we can have 27 people being arrested for doing some boat-headed things. So that is our concern when we talk about that aspect.
Professor, if those numbers are accurate, and I have no reason to doubt them, if those numbers are accurate, why not leave it just decriminalized? Why do you have to legalize?
Well, I think the Reverend has pointed out what happens. This is a very complex issue. You know, part of it is the legal status of the drug and use of the drug. And I'm not a promoter of anybody using any substance that harms them. So I want that to be clear. My gripe is with the how the laws are enacted and enforced. And I don't think there's any doubt that the war on drugs was a war on black people and brown people. Now, if the decriminalization and the legalization has not led to reductions in arrest for the use of marijuana, then somebody needs to look at the policing further in that state. And we already have plenty of evidence around the country that communities of color have been under attack by police departments around the country. So I think that there is a distinction and a separation between the drug laws and how police enforce not only the drug laws but other activities in our communities.
Reverend, there are other clergy members in Connecticut nowadays, and some in New York also, who have an opposite view from you. Have you spoken with them?
We've had conversations with some of these clergy within our state. What I am deeply concerned with is that our folks are not necessarily receiving the adequate information to make an informed decision. It doesn't seem, and I hate to try and throw it on the media, but I watch news every single day and following marijuana for the last 2 years, and it seems that just one side of the coin is what we're hearing on a constant basis. If our people were to receive firsthand information, for example, well, the black market, it's gonna shut down the black market. But if we see that Governor Gavin Newsom in California had to deploy the National Guard, if we hear that in Oregon, since they legalized it, 70% of the marijuana sales are in the black market, our people would probably say, hold on, then what they're saying about putting out the black market, about the social justice piece is what they're saying. And they start to get the facts. People would look at it differently. So I think it's a matter of our folks, the community, receiving more information. I think that if they do, I think that the polls would be a little different. Because
can I talk about the black market for a second, Ron?
Absolutely.
The black market exists because of the legal system. You know, it used to be illegal to scalp tickets in front of Madison Square Garden. It still may, for all I know. But the only, you know, those things are there to protect the existing sellers. The black market in California or wherever these drugs are legal exists because the people in the community either cannot afford to go to the legal market. And my position on that is you should allow anybody to sell it. Now it's better if it's controlled, but I think that the problem is, again, it's the treatment of the substance as being an illegal substance. Now, if you are a seller and you sell something that harms somebody, then, you know, there are laws against that. But, you know, we have to get out of this mindset that we can protect people from themselves on this issue. People have been using marijuana for thousands of years, and it wasn't illegal until black folks in this country were using it, and white folks in this country decided that they wanted to lock black people up for using it. It wasn't always an illegal substance. George Washington grew hemp. Thomas Jefferson grew hemp. So, you know, this is something that's just been around for a long time, and I think it's foolish for us to try to treat it as an illegal substance.
Professor, I just want to mention also the scalpers are still there. They're just
still there.
They're just across the street.
Function.
they're just across the street. They just got a little craftier. He's Professor Fred McKinney. He's the Carlton Highsmith Chair for Innovation and Entrepreneurship and the director of the People's United Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at the Quinnipiac University School of Business. And we're speaking with the professor because He wrote an opinion piece. You can find it online. It's entitled On Marijuana Race in Connecticut. And also joining us is the Reverend Abraham Hernandez, who is the executive director of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference of Connecticut. Reverend, some have said that they were a bit disappointed, since you're in Connecticut, by Governor Lamont, because he is for the legalization. How do you view the current government nowadays?
I am disappointed as well with the governor. We just feel that there's an effort to balance the state's economic crisis and challenges on the backs of our inner cities. When we hear from states or from Connecticut that they say this is going to generate X millions of dollars, and we look at Colorado, where data states that less than 1% of the state's revenue generated in the year comes from marijuana. And we start thinking, for every dollar, some folks say it, I haven't corroborated that, for every dollar that the state generates, they lose $2.5 to $3. This is not the golden parachute that we're constantly hearing from the state house that this is going to be for Connecticut. The cost of marijuana, the value has reduced, the cost of it has reduced 70% in Colorado and other states. What does this say? Supply and demand, the law of supply and demand is dominating it. The black market.
Reverend, I brought up Governor Lamont because he was here recently, and we had a wide-ranging discussion about a number of issues, but one of them was about the potential legalization of marijuana. And when we spoke about it, he said, look, they tried prohibition. How did that work out? And he's used that line in a few different areas around the state, and I've seen the press conferences. Does he have a point? I mean, it hasn't really worked, has it?
Well, when we hear the governor state that about prohibition, and you hear then the other side of law enforcement, and I spoke to a sergeant from the New Britain Police Department, and one of our colleagues spoke to the chief in Norwalk, and he stated, you know, when a lot of our officers respond to a domestic dispute call in our inner cities, and they walk through the doors, they smell the stench of marijuana, and they speak to the parents and say that they have to become counselors and say, listen, your kids cannot be exposed to this. This is going to devastate your home. And we put these two things on a scale, prohibition and what it's already doing in our communities. I think that the cost far outweighs the benefits that it will generate.
Professor McKinney, what about those who say, look, the government, instead of saying legalize marijuana, how about offering programs to improve people's lives, because marijuana is still a drug? So they're saying, put your effort into improving housing, education, getting good paying jobs, fulfilling careers. Instead of thinking about legalizing a drug, go the other direction.
Well, I would disagree with that on the principle it's not an either or situation. You can have legalization and the decriminalization and also increased investment in education, in healthcare, in jobs, and training, and all of those things can and should be done. But let me tell you about, you know, the Reverend mentioned some of the hidden costs. Well, one of the hidden costs, when you arrest 20 million Americans, mainly 65 to 70% of them black and brown men, you are, in my article I point this out, you've like put a scarlet letter on their forehead. Those men that are arrested, they have a criminal record, they can't get jobs. The Brookings Institute in Washington reports that men who've been arrested for drug crimes have a 45% unemployment rate. They're only 20% of these men have an annual income over $15,000. They cannot get jobs. It just creates a perpetual sort of revolving door with the criminal justice system when we arrest men primarily in our communities. Forget about, you know, the disproportionate effect that it has on our community, but when you arrest men and they can't get jobs, can't support themselves, can't support their families. That's the economic cost of this war on black people and brown people associated with calling it the war on drugs. No, it's not. It's a war on black people and brown people.
So going forward in the future, if any legalization takes place, expungement, it sounds like you're saying, should be part of this proposal, this bill?
Absolutely. I mean, you're already seeing it in a number of states, and that's been demanded by community leaders across the country, that if you, when you legalize it, people whose records have been basically influenced by this regime of illegality should have their records expunged.
Reverend Hernandez, would that be okay with you?
Yes, I did want to mention that. I'm glad you highlighted that, because with the 500 clergy that we've been meeting with and are willing to sign on a dotted line and saying we are 100%, we would stand in the forefront, in the front lines with the legislators if they want to work on expungements of records. Because we have folks sitting in our pews who are ex-gangbangers and drug addicts and so on that paid their debt to society. And they still have this hanging, this dark cloud hanging over their heads. They can't get contracts with the government. They can't benefit from other services because they have a felony hanging over their heads. But what we're saying is, let's divorce these two issues. These are two totally separate issues. If you want to talk about expungement of records, we're 100% for that. But legalizing recreational marijuana, we believe it's a totally different game.
I have about a minute left, so if you don't mind, I'm going to give you 30 seconds each for final thoughts. Professor McKinney?
Well, what we know from history is whether it's legal or not, people are going to use it. I believe that if you have it legal, you have a better ability to control it. You have a better ability to educate people about the use of it and actually to discourage the use of it. When it's illegal, it's in the shadows. You negatively impact people's lives, their families' lives. It perpetuates poverty. And I just think that we've learned a lesson. I mean, let's look at the data. This war has not worked.
Reverend Hernandez, about 45 seconds, sir.
Yes. I believe that with the vaping crisis that the CDC has stated, it's an epidemic with over 7 million of our kids in our schools. And hearing from principals saying that even in our middle schools we have our kids vaping, it's something that should cause us to take a pause. I believe that we seem to be riding this wave. If we could step back, the jury is still out on this. Let's look at data and evidence as to the repercussions in those states where this is happening. Then Connecticut can come back and make a decision. But it's very premature to do that at this time. And I think that we're playing Russian roulette with our kids.
The Reverend Abraham Hernandez is the Executive Director of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference of Connecticut. Professor Fred McKinney is the Carlton Highsmith Chair for Innovation and Entrepreneurship and Director of the People's United Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at the Quinnipiac University School of Business. And once again, that opinion piece he wrote at Marijuana Race in Connecticut, if you just Google that, you can find it online. Professor, Reverend, thank you both. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you want to join us in commenting on today's program, email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org, and on Facebook, we're at Full Story WSHU. That is going to do it for our show today. Sabrina Garone's our engineer, Carrie Franks, the digital editor. Our associate producers are Sabrina Garone, Desiree DiOrio, Roberto Rojas, Fatou Sangari. J.D. Allen is the producer, and Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.